The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and from the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And first, I'm going to complete the May issue of the Harvard Heart Letter. And the first article is on an interesting subject, Hospital at Home, a Movement Whose Time Has Come. This safe, cost-effective model relies on home visits and technology to provide hospital-level care at home and is especially well-suited for people with heart failure. Every year, 1 million Americans find out they have heart failure. This diagnosis isn't quite as dire as the name sounds. Still, it's one of the top three reasons older people are admitted to a hospital, and about half of these people return within 6 months. But what if you could receive the same high-level care for this common condition in the comfort of your own home? Hospital at home isn't just a dream, but a well-researched concept that's been around for decades and is already practiced in Australia and many European countries. Now it's finally starting to take hold in the United States, thanks to a waiver from the federal government that currently allows Medicare to pay for the program. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the rising number of aging adults in this country, made it very obvious that we need to increase our capacity for providing hospital-level care, says emergency medicine physician Dr. Jared Conley, associate director of the Healthcare Transformation Lab at Massachusetts General Hospital. Back in 2016, he and colleagues launched hospital-at-home programs there and at Brigham and Women's, another Harvard-affiliated hospital. Their early experience focused on treating people with a variety of medical conditions, but especially worsening heart failure, which often accounted for one-third of hospitalizations, he says. The hospital-at-home programs at the two Harvard hospitals were found to be just as safe and effective as in-hospital care, with equal or improved survival rates. People also preferred the at-home care and were less likely to require repeat hospitalizations. Another bonus, hospital-at-home care was 30% to 40% less expensive, says Dr. Conley. Of course, some people are too ill and unstable to receive care at home, but many people who need less extensive treatment are good candidates for hospital at home, where a doctor oversees your care visits once daily, sometimes by video conferencing, along with nurses or paramedics who come to your home twice a day. If you have heart failure, you may have a video consultation with a cardiologist to fine-tune your treatment. Treating an episode of worsening heart failure usually requires intravenous medications that help remove fluid from the lungs and elsewhere in the body. In addition to setting up the apparatus to deliver those drugs, nurses or other care team members can draw blood and carry out other tests, including portable ultrasounds of the heart and chest x-rays as needed. Healthcare team members will check your vital signs daily, but you'll also be constantly monitored with a small patch on your chest that measures your heart rate and rhythm, breathing rate and activity. It also features a sensor that determines if you've fallen. All equipment is provided by the care team, including the tablet used for video visits, and, if needed, a separate device to enable a fast, reliable internet connection. Home is a much better environment for healing. You sleep better, you're less sedentary, and you can have more social interaction with family and friends. Before the pandemic, there were no more than 20 hospital-at-home programs in the United States. But once the Medicare waiver took effect, The care model increased exponentially, says Dr. Conley. Today, there are 260 hospitals in 37 states in various stages of starting or expanding their programs to provide at-home hospital-level care. In December 2022, Congress approved an extension of the waiver for another 2 years. Heart failure cases are expected to rise significantly in coming years as America ages. Instead of building more brick-and-mortar hospitals, which often require capital outlays of $2 billion each, we have a unique opportunity to rethink the way we care for people. Our North Star for patient care should be maximizing days spent healing safely in the comfort of our own homes, Dr. Conley says. And there's a little attached section that says, what is heart failure? Although the term heart failure implies your heart has stopped working, that's not the case. Instead, the heart doesn't pump well and struggles to supply sufficient blood to meet the body's needs. The resulting fatigue, weakness, and shortness of breath tend to wax and wane, but slowly worsen over time. Sometimes symptoms worsen suddenly and require hospitalization. Finally, I'm going to read an article entitled Yoga, a Flexible Way to Enhance Heart Health, again from the Harvard Heart Letter. This adaptable practice targets several fitness goals at once and may also boost mental and physical health. We tend to think of exercise as movement, and that either raises your heart rate or builds muscle. But two other factors, flexibility and balance, are also important for a well-rounded fitness program, especially for older adults. A yoga practice has the potential to target all four factors at the same time. What's more, a recent study suggests that yoga has modest yet positive effects on several factors linked to cardiovascular health. The reason behind these benefits isn't entirely clear, but we believe that multiple simultaneous mechanisms are probably at play, says Dr. Darshan Mehta, medical director of the Harvard-affiliated Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine. Yoga is more than simply stretching and moving into poses. It weaves together three interconnected threads: physical postures, controlled breathing, and meditation. Together, they help cultivate the relaxation response, which trains your body to be less reactive during times of stress. The relaxation response not only slows the heart rate and lowers blood pressure, it may also tamp down inflammation and promote favorable changes in blood vessel function that protect the heart. As a mind-body practice, yoga encourages people to slow down and be more mindful about heart-healthy behaviors, like eating well and getting enough sleep, says Dr. Mehta. Those habits, along with positive emotions that some form of yoga aim to inspire, like compassion and gratitude, may also help foster cardiovascular benefits. Finding your fit. Think you can't do yoga because you aren't flexible? By practicing yoga, you become more flexible. That's another reason to do it, says clinical social worker and yoga teacher Laura Malloy, director of yoga programs at the Benson Henry Institute. If you're new to yoga, seek out a beginner or gentle class, especially if you're over 65 or if you have a medical condition. Several forms are well-suited to beginners, like Hatha yoga, which features gentle, smooth movements that are integrated with your breathing. Iyengar is similar, but places more emphasis on body alignment and balance and uses props like straps, blankets, and blocks. Yin yoga, which is done mostly sitting or lying down, encourages people to go deeper into poses by holding them longer. Another option is chair yoga, practice sitting in a chair, or standing using a chair for support. It's good for older people or anyone who feels less steady or has trouble getting up from the floor, though gentle chair yoga still provides results. After I teach a 20-minute chair yoga class, I've heard people say, "Wow, that made such a difference in how I feel," says Malloy. You can find classes at dedicated yoga studios as well as health clubs, community or senior centers, or even hospitals. Costs range from $15 to $20 per class. Yoga of the Heart, a form of yoga designed for people who have heart disease, is taught by instructors trained and certified by Nishala Joy Devi, who developed the yoga portion of the Dean Ornish program for reversing heart disease, an evidence-based integrated lifestyle program for heart patients. Click the Teacher Directory tab at health.harvard.edu/HY to search for trained instructors near you. Now we're going to go on to the Harvard Women's Health Watch. This is the May 2023 issue. The first article in the Harvard Women's Health Watch of May 2023 is entitled "Invisible Illness, More Than Meets the Eye." Many people live with health conditions that can't be seen, but there are ways to ease the burden. You've just parked your car when you notice someone pull into a nearby handicap spot, pop out of her vehicle, and smoothly walk into the store. What gives, you may think? She doesn't look sick. Chances are she has a condition that can't be seen by the naked eye. So-called invisible illness affects an estimated 10% of the 61 million Americans who deal with a physical or mental ailment that limits their movement or senses, according to the CDC. And while a quarter of American adults have a condition that can be considered a disability, only a fraction use visible supports like a cane or a wheelchair, meaning most don't appear disabled. Invisible illness encompasses a laundry list of conditions ranging from the common to the obscure. It's easy to imagine that people with heart failure, cancer, diabetes, depression, or dementia might fly under the radar despite dealing with frequent exhaustion, common pain, nerve damage, or trouble thinking or remembering. But perhaps more opaque are ailments with wax and wane symptoms, like lupus, digestive disorders, multiple sclerosis, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, or rheumatoid arthritis, all of which affect more women than men. A huge number of people are sick and just walk around with it, carrying their terrible burden that affects every aspect of their life, says Dr. Daniel Sands, a primary care doctor at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It's often not until people have a stroke, or they're wasting from cancer, or they have severe anemia from some blood condition, that they're actually going to look sick. I'd argue that most illnesses are invisible illnesses, unless people choose to talk about them. Beyond physical challenges, people with invisible illness also shoulder unique emotional baggage. Every day brings weighty decisions about whether or when to disclose their condition, and how to deal with possible mixed reactions. People can't see your suffering, so they may not understand or help you. They might not even believe you. It's a big emotional load, Dr. Sands says. People are scowling at you because you took that handicapped parking space, but maybe you're in intense pain when you walk or don't have the lung capacity to walk very far. It might seem logical then to just tell everyone what you're dealing with, but that may be easier said than done if you worry divulging your illness will make you seem incapable or entitled. A small study published online March 15, 2022 by the journal Disabilities highlighted this dilemma. Many of the 25 participants with invisible conditions said that they feared that disclosure might cost them career opportunities or be viewed by coworkers as faking it to get on-the-job perks. Dr. Sands was stunned when a colleague confided that she struggled with lifelong depression, so crushing that she sometimes can't work. "I had no idea, and there are so many people out there like her," he says. "Mental illness is a great example of something even doctors find to be invisible." One of Dr. Sands' patients has a young-onset Parkinson's disease, a diagnosis he hid for years despite obvious tremors. His wife would tell others he was just fidgety. He was uncomfortable admitting to friends and family that he has Parkinson's because he associated that with being old, Dr. Sands recalls. But keeping your illness under wraps comes with distinct drawbacks, fueling a haunting sense of separation. "It's lonely to have something you're keeping a secret. It's isolating," Dr. Sands says. "If you don't share that with people, you don't get the emotional and social support you need that might help you handle things better. Deciding to tell others about your health condition is always your prerogative, so never feel you must, but recognize that people can't help or support you if you don't," says Dr. Suzanne Salomon, clinical chief of gerontology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. "I think it can lift a burden," Dr. Salomon says. "A relationship can be strengthened by disclosure, and you may find the person you're telling also has an invisible illness. This can deepen conversation and connection." If you decide to disclose your condition, Dr. Sands offers this advice. Keep the description of your illness simple and straightforward. Explain that your symptoms are hard to see and may wax and wane. Try using easy-to-understand words instead of complex medical terms. Send your friend to a reputable website that describes your condition, he says. Tell others how your illness limits you. If someone asks and you're comfortable doing so, you can say, for instance, "For years I've been struggling with rheumatoid arthritis, and it's really taken a toll on me. I think opening up about these things is almost always for the best," he says. If there are ways people can help you, let them know, Dr. Sands says. Also look to online or in-person support communities, which can bring a welcome sense of understanding. Other people in that community will be struggling with the same issues, he says. Now we're going to continue with the Harvard Women's Health Watch and go to a section called Ask the Doctors with Dr. Tony Golan and Dr. Hope Riccioletti. The first question is, "I've had a nail-biting habit for as long as I can remember, but now a new friend is telling me my nibbling could actually harm my health. Is that true?" Your friend is correct. Think about it this way. How many things do you touch every day, whether doorknobs, money, or even your phone? Our fingertips are germ collectors, even when we don't bite our nails. But this habit makes you especially vulnerable to dirt and grime that can collect in nail beds, since nibbling leaves cuticles and skin ragged and creates tiny fissures in your skin that germs can pass through. By putting your nails in your mouth, you're carrying germs for a variety of illnesses that range from the common cold to salmonella infection. You can also develop an infection in the skin around your nails and under the nail bed itself. Admittedly, it's not easy to quit biting your nails, but it's important to do so. Try to find ways to occupy your mouth and hands, like chewing gum, or drinking water, or doing needlework or drawing, so you're less tempted to nibble on your nails. Question: I put off annual physicals during the pandemic and finally have a wellness visit scheduled. What should I make sure to ask my doctor? You're certainly not alone in postponing your checkup, since an estimated 32% of American adults delayed routine medical care during the pandemic. it's wise to resume annual visits, both to get a proper diagnosis for any health problems that have cropped up and to talk with your doctor about ways you can stay healthy. Beyond telling your doctor about any changes you've noticed or responding to her questions during the exam, you should ask several of your own. For example, am I due for any vaccinations? Your age, health history, occupation, and lifestyle all affect the type of vaccinations you need. It may also be time for a booster shot. Which health screenings or blood tests do I need? Mammogram, colonoscopy, and other screenings shouldn't be postponed for long, since early detection can mean the difference between a treatable or an untreatable condition. Do I need any change in my prescription? Changes to your health or lifestyle can influence dosage. Some medications may no longer be necessary, or a new medication may be appropriate. What lifestyle changes should I consider to improve my overall health? Blood pressure or weight changes may make it smart to tweak your diet or your exercise patterns. Now here's a useful article called Toss Your Reading Glasses. Today's cataract surgery offers personalized lens choices to suit your goals and needs. Most surgeries are considered successful if they merely fix the problem at hand. But today's cataract surgery goes a step further, often leaving your vision better than before. A cataract, a cloudiness in the lens of the eye, will affect about half of us before age 75. The condition can make everyday activities like reading, handiwork, golf, driving at night, progressively more difficult. But cataracts are typically a late-life addition to other vision problems like being nearsighted, farsighted, or seeing blurry at all distances from astigmatism. While cataract surgery has been the go-to treatment for 7 decades, it has evolved dramatically. Recent years have served up a variable a la carte menu of lens choices to replace the natural ones removed during the procedure. These customizable options not only restore unclouded vision, but often reduce your need for glasses or contacts. Some people can even toss their long-needed reading glasses, says Dr. Nandini Venkatesawaran, a surgeon specializing in cataract surgery and corneal disease at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. The effect of getting one of the more advanced lenses can be similar to laser surgery for vision correction. Back in the day, we were just trying to get the cataract out. Now we're trying to figure out which lens will help make each person happiest. Patient experiences are much more nuanced. Vision difficulties often creep up as cataracts form. Your glasses seem not to work anymore. Colors appear faded. Everything looks dimmer, or the glare from oncoming headlights seems overwhelming. Even after your doctor confirms you have cataracts, a process that involves a comprehensive eye exam, you won't necessarily need surgery right away. Your doctor may recommend the procedure sooner if you also have another eye condition that cataracts make harder to manage. In the meantime, you might be able to boost your visual clarity by trying a few other strategies, like using brighter lights or a magnifying glass to do detailed tasks like reading or needlework, avoiding nighttime driving or wearing tinted glasses that cut glare. Deciding to go ahead with cataract surgery is just the first step. The next is determining which type of replacement lens is best suited to your vision and goals. It's wise to check your health insurance coverage before this point. Dr. Venkatesawaran notes, most advanced lenses are costly and aren't covered. Lens options include the following. Monofocal. This fixed focus lens offers the ability to see clearly at one distance point, whether up close, far away, or at arm's length. you'll need glasses for all the other distances you didn't choose. Depending on what you spend much of your day doing, it's nice to have a lens that's focused for that. You might also choose a lens providing near vision for one eye and far vision for the other, a combination called monovision. It can be the best of both worlds, allowing you to ditch your glasses more of the time. Toric. This is a special type of monofocal lens geared toward people with astigmatism, a flaw in the curvature of the cornea that compensates for the eye's abnormal shape. Like a regular monofocal lens, it focuses vision at a single distance, allowing you to be more independent of glasses for the distance you choose. Extended depth of focus. This lens offers much improved distance and middle vision, pairing your overall need for glasses. But keep those readers handy. Close-up vision doesn't typically improve. Wide range. Also known as multifocal or trifocal lenses, these options work like progressive or bifocal lenses in eyeglasses. Your eyes and brain work together to decide which part of the lens you need at any given moment. It's a nice option for individuals who want to be out of glasses 90% of the time. But these lenses do pose higher risks of experiencing glare and halos around bright lights. The newest technology features a customizable lens containing light-sensitive material that allows the focusing distance to be changed by light treatment soon after the surgery. Patients can try the lenses, see if they like the distance they've chosen, and lock it in after the surgery, Dr. Venkatesa Warren says. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.